of oppression when we are building real resistance.
Radio.
Arguments are not going to attract people. Winning is going to attract people.
Radio.
The Poor People's Riot, as they call it, was necessary, it was reasonable, and it was just.
Radio.
And if you get in my way to make sure that that man gets housing, or that he gets enough to eat, I will move you.
Radio.
Okay.
Hello, this is CKLN 88.1 Word of Mouth OCAP Radio coming at you from the Ryerson campus. I, Kelly Bentley, and AJ Weathers will be your hosts for today, and we have quite a lineup. First, we will be talking to David McNally, author of Global Slump, The Economics and Politics of Crisis and Resistance, and we will be discussing the economic crisis with him. We will then be talking to Monica Adams from Freedom Inc., direct from Wisconsin, about the attack on public sector unions and the protests going on there. And we'll be talking to Rachel Hewitt and Amina Ali about the changes to the special diet and possibly listening to a clip from John Clark about the Rob Ford action that happened at City Hall. Next, headlines.
And hello and welcome. We are here on the other side of the booth, on the other side of the glass. My name is Susie Alvarez.
And I'm Sheetha Lodia.
And we'll be doing headlines for tonight. And we begin...
With some world news. Here's a piece of news that hits close to home. Radio Free Libya truly went free yesterday. For the first time in 42 years, broadcasts on Libyan radio went unmonitored by the state. According to news reports, staff members had to take some moments to calm themselves before going on the air. Anwar Sharif, Radio Free Libya's most famous voice, says, quote, "There was a fear barrier broken. I sounded sentimental, even hysterical. We let loose all the words we could never say." End quote. Formerly monitored by in-house intelligence agents, the station is now the voice of anti-government activists. Indeed, given that most of the state-run newspapers have stopped printing and the Gaddafi regime has shut down the internet and cell phones, Radio Free Libya, housed in a dilapidated building, has become the most important source of information. Staff members of the station have stated that their goal is to promote national unity and give a voice to people's grievances. Indeed, on a larger scale, the state of journalism in Libya has shifted radically. Whereas for decades foreign presses were shut out of Libya, foreign journalists are now being welcomed, and alternative media are proving to be the most important forms for information exchange and dissemination. According to the White House spokesperson Jay Carner, the United States has suspended embassy operations in Libya and is moving forward with unilateral sanctions against the government of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Carney also stated that Washington supports the suspension of Libya from the United Nations. The United Nations, in fact, is warning that thousands of people may have been killed in Gaddafi's assault on the growing popular uprising across Libya. The UN is warning also that Libya's food supply is quickly diminishing.
And thousands of supporters and opponents of Ali Abdullah Saleh, Yemen's president, have held rallies in the capital, Sana'a, in Yemen. Yemen has been swept up in protests inspired by the recent successful uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia. The demonstrators are demanding that Saleh, in power for 32 years, step down. 17 people have died in the past 9 days in a sustained wave of nationwide anti-Saleh protest. The president has said he will not give in to, quote, anarchy and killing, unquote. And in Madison, Wisconsin, yesterday, tens of thousands of people rallied in support of Wisconsin public employees. Under jeopardy are collective bargaining powers for public employees who have been fighting for health benefits and pensions. Protesters rallied against the bill proposed by Republican Governor Scott Walker, which promises to reduce public employee union bargaining power and force state workers to pay more for pensions and health insurances. Since 1983, there has been a steady decline in union memberships from 27% in 83 to just 17% currently. According to university professors, this steady decline can be attributed to a reduction in private manufacturing, which was once at 31% in 1983 and is now below 8%. Many famous faces were at the rally, including Reverend Jesse Jackson and Tom Morello, guitarist for Rage Against the Machine, who commented on the energy and sense of support at the rally for union workers. But students and teachers have been the greatest forces on the front lines of the protest in Wisconsin. For the past 11 days, protesters have been staging sit-ins, sleep-ins, assemblies in protest at the Capitol building. According to reports, so many protesters have been staying on the Capitol building grounds that there are now dining areas, lending libraries, and medic centers on site. Protesters fear that Wisconsin could follow in the footsteps of other Republican states such as Idaho, Indiana, and Ohio, which have been stripped of union and public employees' rights. In fact, in Ohio, thousands are expected to protest against the Senate Bill 5, which will switch the current pension and health systems to a merit-pay system. The Wisconsin State Assembly has, in fact, now approved Governor Walker's proposal with 51 votes in favor and 17 against following overnight vote session. And we will hear more about Wisconsin and what's happening there in a few minutes when we make contact with Freedom Inc.
And now we turn to some news about Haiti. While the UK and the US have made statements towards supporting the return of Haitian exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Canada has yet to voice an opinion. At issue is the extent to which Haiti's new democratic electoral system is being supported by others. In fact, foreign involvement in the Haitian electoral process continues. In March, the Haitian election will begin its second round runoff with two candidates, Milran Maniguet and Michel Martelly, candidates who have been strongly endorsed by the US and other foreign presences in Haiti. In an interview with Montreal's L'Autre Journal, Mario Joseph, Haiti's leading human rights lawyer, has argued that in neglecting to demand the cancellation of the fraudulent vote and in failing to support new, fair, and democratic elections, Canada has thus accepted an anti-democratic framework.
And now we go to national news. At a recent Citizenship and Immigration Canada conference, discussion center on the distribution of federal funding for immigration agencies and services. Of the 452 groups who apply for funding, only 260 were given money, which means that many agencies have been forced to cut services between 5 and 40%. Last Thursday, Eric Hoskins, the Ontario Immigration Minister, revealed that there will be a $500,000 relief fund to help agencies affected by the cuts, a move that is now under scrutiny by Ottawa, whose priorities over immigrant services are different from the provinces. Says Hoskins, quote, "We will not accept an unfair agreement that puts newcomers who settle in Ontario at a disadvantage," unquote. Locally, Toronto loses about $18 million for immigration services. Most agencies are in agreement that Canada should assess distribution of funds based on needs. However, these agencies are angered by the lack of federal consultation on how cuts should be made. The federal government demonstrates an overarching lack of transparency and a lack of faith in agencies to weigh in on important decisions.
And last, in local news, the TTC has announced that it will look into changing its post-secondary student pass program to allow discounted passes for full-time students only. This is one of the cuts being considered in order to save money and will affect roughly 49,000 part-time students, many of whom are low-income, single-parent, and or disabled.
And now we're going to go to a music break. We'll be right back with more news and views and opinions. You're tuning into CKLN 88.1 FM. This is Friday Word of Mouth News, and it's OCAP Radio.
Inside your mind, bucket seats behind your eyes, unquestioned direction was in my feet. I was raised by your machine, educated by your TVs. I never doubted your writing. In this world, oh, touch my hair. I cannot work these things when I'm numb and unprepared. These are not my hands. This is not my skin. Does this not feel like someone else were in?
David McNally is a political science professor at York University. He has written several books, including Another World is Possible, Globalization and Anti-Capitalism, and most recently, Global Slump, The Economics and Politics of Crisis and Resistance. He is also involved in social justice organizing in the city and efforts to make information about the economy widely available and accessible. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us. I guess my first question is, many commentators in the mainstream media are talking about the economic crisis as if it's over. And what are your thoughts on this matter?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that the crisis may be over for the big banks, but for poor and working class people, it continues and it gets worse. And it gets worse because when we had the huge wave of bank collapses in 2008-2009, when, for instance, all five Wall Street investment banks went under, followed by a chain reaction of bank collapses in Europe. When that happened, the governments and central banks of all the richest nations engaged in a massive coordinated bailout of the banking system. That means they literally just took public money and pumped it into the banks. And they did that to the tune of about $20 trillion. Now, that's a huge figure, but to give you a sense of what $20 trillion means, that's equal to all the wealth the U.S. economy creates in a year and a half.
Yes.
And they pumped that into the banking system. But the problem was they ran up huge debts to do that. And now they have to figure out how to pay down those debts, and they've had a really simple solution, what they've called the age of austerity, which essentially means that they're gunning now for the social programs upon which poor and working class people depend, whether it's education, social assistance, health care, and of course the public sector jobs,
yes,
nurses, teachers, hospital workers, and others who are the service deliverers, the service providers. So we're now into this phase of the crisis. First was the banking collapse. Then came the great bailout to the tune of $20 trillion. Now the age of austerity, which will be the longest phase. This will go on for years and years. Some people in the mainstream are saying a generation. So what it means is a long period of crisis for working class and poor people around the world, and it takes so many different forms, including even the food crisis that has been so huge in parts of the global south. So, yeah, the crisis may be over for banks, but it sure is not for the vast majority of us.
Yes. So, Global Slump, the economics and politics of crisis and resistance. Why now? Why write that now? What do you think it says?
Well, I wanted to get several points across to people. The first being, of course, what we've just talked about. The crisis is not gone.
That's right.
Secondly, that has huge implications for people who are committed to, in the first instance, social justice, but even people who are committed to just basic decency for working people in our society. And I wanted to really get across to readers that we need to start thinking in strategic terms about what we're trying to do over the next 5 or 10 years as social justice organizations and communities. Because very often we're required to simply react to events. But this is a moment where we have to be, I think, not simply reactive, but also strategic. We need to really start thinking, okay, if this is an age of austerity, how does that change the way we think about what we're doing. In one conversation recently, I said to somebody that the crisis we've been living through is a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
Rules of the game for corporate power and governments are changing. Mm-hmm. They're simply more aggressive. What we're seeing, for instance, in Wisconsin.
Yes.
You know, we're not just going to come in and savage social services. We're going to take away collective bargaining rights.
That's right.
I don't know how many of your listeners, Kelly, caught the announcement earlier this week that the state of Michigan has told the city of Detroit that it will have to close half its schools.
Wow.
Half the schools will close, and they acknowledge this means class sizes up to 60 for poor, predominantly African-American people in the city of Detroit. So that's what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
California, 900,000 children have lost health care.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just the first wave of cuts. So I really wanted to get across the idea, don't buy the notion that this is an ordinary recession and then job creation and economic recovery will follow. This is a long-term period, and we're going to have to really get innovative, really get creative, get very serious about building the networks of solidarity and resistance that we need on a much higher scale if we're going to respond appropriately.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything specific about this crisis? Because, like, you know, you've heard of crises before, right? There's crises in the 1970s, there was crises in the 1990s in Asia. Is there anything specific about this crisis that is different than the others?
I think there is, mm-hmm. and I would say really some of the following about it. First, this crisis began in the global north.
Mm-hmm.
That tells you that the core of the system was being rocked by a whole series of economic problems and contradictions. Throughout the whole neoliberal period since the late 70s, the crises that had happened at the margins. It happened in the global south. So you might get a Mexican crisis, or a crisis in Argentina, or a crisis in East Asia. But the core of the global capitalist economy had not been rocked like this.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the indicators that this is something very, very different. Then the second was how quickly it globalized.
Mm-hmm.
Crisis that may have begun with the collapse of some banks on Wall Street, but it was soon affecting the whole of the international economy. And so at one level, therefore, it is like the 1930s. It is like the Great Depression in terms of being a systemic crisis and being one that's hitting the very core of international capitalism. But the big difference, contrary to the 1930s, is how the central banks in these countries coordinated the bailout. They failed to do that in the 1930s, and that's the sense in which our rulers learned something from the last systemic crisis. And so it means it takes a different character. Rather than having the whole bottom fall out of the economy for 5 or 6 years in a row of banking collapses and meltdowns, they've changed the form of it. It doesn't mean that the crisis went away, but they did manage to essentially take all of this bad private debt that the banks had built up that
yes.
they could never get proper repayment on, and they turned it into public debt.
Mm-hmm.
They did that much more quickly than they managed in the 1930s. And that's why, rather than a crisis which is going to take the form, say, of 25% unemployment rates, which is what happened in the U.S. and Canada by 1933-34, so, you know, about 4 or 5 years into the Great Depression, rather than taking that form, it's much more likely to be this sort of officially 10% unemployment. Unofficially, of course, we know it's more like 16 or 17%. When you factor in all the people who are really out of work.
That's right.
But it's going to have much more the character of this wave of attacks on the public sector, both the people working there, as we've talked about, and also the services they provide. So the similarity with the 1930s is that it's systemic and that it's at the core of the system and that it's long-term. The most unique feature in terms of the recent past is how the global north is now going through the kind of so-called structural adjustment
programs
that the global south got in the 1980s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, David, I wish I could speak longer with you, but we do have a really long lineup, and I want to say thank you so much for giving us sort of a, I guess would be a sound bite. I wish it was much more intensive and longer about what's going on in the economy. And, you know, on the left, we often don't have a voice, so it's really important that we have these formats, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kelly, and all my best wishes to everyone at CKLN.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
They can take our bones and bury them deep under the river, but we'll still be together, and we cannot be defeated. They can take our trombones and pack them down there with us, but no matter how long it takes us, we will not be defeated. When we dance together under the moon and under the weather. We will lock our eyes forever in the night. Well, they can take our bones and bury them deep under the river, but we'll still be together, and we cannot be defeated. They can take our fists and chop them off at the wrist, and we will shake our arms with bloody stumps, and we cannot be defeated when we
Okay, that was Rock Plaza Central's Anthem for the Already Defeated. And I am AJ Withers. Up next, we have Monica Adams from Freedom Inc., who will be joining us from the streets in Madison, Wisconsin, amid the mass protests that have been taking place there. Freedom Inc. says that its primary goals consist of looking at new definitions and solutions to end all forms of violence, including systemic racism, sexism, cisgenderism, classism, ableism, issues of nationality, etc., against women, genderqueer folks, and youth to promote healthier living. The leadership of Freedom Inc. comes from the community. They hire from only within the community, and all of their staff are people of color, female-born, many identifying as women, some gender nonconforming. They do their work also with an intergenerational lens, so they have both youth and adult staff and youth members on their board. And their work is and will remain grassroots to ensure that people who are most affected by the issues lead the struggles around those issues and that they are equal partners in addressing them. Monica Adams is a Black, gay woman, working class, and gender nonconforming, a community organizer, a scientist, and an activist. She brings a critical perspective to the fight in Madison, Wisconsin. Her knowledge and investment in revolutionary political leadership and radical movements of low-income people of color are high and vital. As an activist scholar, she couples her lived experiences with her historical and theoretical framework that she sharpens her analysis of political power, access, resource, and control. As a grassroots organizer in Wisconsin, she has years of experience in addressing the root causes of oppression on the ground. Her work is based in centering the leadership of those most affected and building alternative society by means to end oppressions. She has been involved in organizing in Madison, Wisconsin, through the Freedom Inc. and Take Back the Land organizations for a very long time. Monica, are you there?
Here.
Thank you so much for joining us, Monica.
Sure.
So I just wanted to start off by asking you what's going on the streets of Madison right now.
So there are tomorrow It's supposed to be probably the largest day in terms of number of folks who come out in protest. But the folks are still occupying spaces in the Capitol. Folks are still pushing for folks to boycott and picket WMC, which is Wisconsin Manufacturers Commerce, which are people who fund Scott Walker and his campaign, essentially. And so folks are still there occupying space. Last night, I slept over again, and they voted through the, in the assembly. Their tactic was to stall kind of the legislation at the assembly level, but unfortunately, it was kind of pushed through very quickly. And so folks are regrouping, figuring out ways to strengthen the existing strategy because, yeah, folks are really being pushed right now. So that's kind of how things are looking.
Okay.
But folks are still going. They're still going strong. Busloads of folks will be coming in tomorrow, and we're preparing for that.
Okay. And what kinds of folks are protesting right now? We're hearing in the mainstream media that it's largely public sector workers. Are there other people that are joining the protests, and who are those people?
I'm absolutely glad you mentioned that. There are tons of public sector folks, teachers, union workers, firefighters, police. There are police protesting as well as he recently called in police to, quote-unquote, police the situation. So there's a lot of uniformed folks around to ensure order or whatever that means. And but in addition to that, and sort of the kind of the work that we're doing at Freedom League, is there are rallies within the rally, right? There's a fight within the fight, and that would be like low-income communities of color who aren't getting the same kind of support or whose agenda isn't in the mainstream narrative. And specifically, folks are really rallying around Badger Care, which a lot of low-income folks, communities of color, use. It's a health care provided by the state or through state funds. So folks are really rallying around Badger Care, Food Share, which is food support, which you can receive, you know, over like a little debit card, also known as food stamps, if folks there are familiar with that. So folks, yeah, so black folks, Southeast Asian folks, Latino folks are really there to push the agenda. There are also radical organizations who are fighting for rights for folks with disabilities. They actually took over the GOP office and are planning to stay there until Medicare is removed off the bill, off the chopping block, so to speak.
Wow, that sounds like a lot. And do you think that there are implications for what happens in Madison or in Wisconsin for the rest of the country or even for places in Canada around what kind of austerity measures they're able to implement?
Yes, legislatively, politically, and also socially. So already, so Madison has a lot of bodies here doing the work, so we get a lot of attention, but there are cities all around the state that are doing similar protests and organizing, and then there are also other states within the country who are protesting and doing similar organizing because Scott Walker's agenda isn't unique to him. It's for a couple other Republicans who are all around the country who are trying to implement. Basically, Wisconsin is a pilot. If it's successful here, they will do whatever they need to do to ensure it happens in other places. So there's a lot invested. There's a lot invested in what happens here. So that's kind of on the political legislative side. But also socially, what we're seeing right now, or what appears to be happening, is that there's this unified front, so to speak, like we talked about the different groups that are there. But there's a lot of fractures within the movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be careful about how we negotiate things, if it should even be negotiation, but careful how we should negotiate things, how we talk about ourselves, the movement, because a lot of the folks who are out protesting were people who voted for Scott Walker. And essentially he got in on this whole end welfare kick where it was very much villainizing low-income folks of color, specifically women of color, And he's trying to increase increase money that goes to prisons. So his villainizing of like black men and also other men of color, So a lot of the people who were, I guess, agreeing with that kind of politics, voted him in.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the same people essentially that we're rallying with. So there's a lot of fracturing
mm-hmm.
that's happening. And what we are fearful of, specifically communities of color and the organizing work that we do here, is that if negotiations happen, the white middle class folks are going to get what they want, and then we're left on the chopping block
mm-hmm.
without the numbers and without the support of mainstream media and also resources that are so far supporting this protest.
And I also wanted to just ask you, a lot of the mainstream media is also portraying this as a spontaneous protest that people just went to the streets. And I wanted to ask, what kind of organizing led up to this kind of protest within your organization and in the community to create the resources and spirit in order to be able to do these protests?
I think different people came into the protest in different ways. Specifically, Freedom Inc., we have always been doing grassroots organizing in communities, political education around social issues, teaching people different organizing techniques, tactics, to be able to mobilize around something like this. So for us, this isn't particularly new. We saw it coming. Scott Walker had pretty much destroyed Milwaukee, which is a lot of folks of color live there. And so we had already seen this coming. So we were already preparing to mobilize around it, right? Mm-hmm. But I think for other folks who voted him in specifically, they didn't necessarily see this coming, mm-hmm. right? So I think for them, it's a newer thing in a sense. But I think a lot of what's happening draws off kind of the legacy of organizing that had come before people, mm-hmm. like specifically like labor rights movements, workers' rights movements, so on and so forth. But I think this kind of organizing isn't new to communities of color. It's, a lot of it is in our history. It's in our blood. So I think folks are also regrouping now to figure out what would be a stronger strategy or what would be the strategy to give them what they want. Mm-hmm. Is it solely occupying space or what is it?
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, Monica. And just before I let you go, I'm wondering if there's anything that people here in Toronto can do to support.
I think really speaking truth to power is what's really going to help folks who don't get in the mainstream narrative of things, so communities of color, queer folks, because I do, and folks with disabilities, folks who haven't necessarily been mentioned. I think how folks are rendered invisible is a layer of oppression, and I think that's going to play out a lot in terms of who gets what and how resources are split. Mm-hmm. So I think really speaking truth to power, really highlighting what's happening to targeted communities, I really think drawing attention to existing class oppressions, different things like that, I think are really helpful. And if folks are interested in supporting the work, I think I strongly urge that they look to on-the-ground organizers who have been doing the organizing for a very long time, but they not receive the same sort of recognition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks so much. Best of luck with everything in Madison. And now we're going to listen to Ryan Newell's The Face of the Sky.
Even small waves make sounds when they reach the shore. Even dandelions quiver, even old lovers sway and sway. Even small waves make sounds when they reach the shore. Even dandelions quiver, even old lovers sway and sway. Even so steady and unstill, even so steady and unstill, even so steady and unstill. Even the day's clouds never rest. The face of the sky is turbulence. The face of the sky is turbulence. The face of the sky is turbulence. The face of the sky is turbulence.
So that was Ryan Newell, whose birthday is this week, I believe. So if you're friends with him, give him a happy birthday. Up next is Rachel Hewitt, who is a longtime OCAP member and organizer. She does a great deal of OCAP's casework and has been researching the changes to the special diet, what they mean, and how they will affect people on welfare and disability in Ontario. Hello, Rachel.
Hi there.
So first off, maybe you could just, for folks who don't know, explain what the special diet is.
The special diet is an allowance that people on welfare and disability can get with a doctor's essentially prescription that allows each person or child in a family access to $250 monthly.
Okay, and how widespread has the access of this benefit been in recent years?
in about 2005, OCAP began publicizing how to get this money as a means to try to supplement a really, really inadequate level of assistance in the province. And in these last years, about one in five people on assistance in Ontario have accessed that money in some way.
Okay, so obviously affecting a large number of folks in the province. What are the changes coming down the pipe to the special diet benefit?
Basically, what the government has done is further restricted access to the special diet, which they've done several times before, but this is definitely the most serious go at that. They've reduced the number of conditions that you can get special diet money for, removed a number of them, removed the way that you can access them if you're, let's say, have HIV and are losing weight. And they've also added a medical release form to the form, which everybody has to sign, which will allow workers access to people's medical information. And, of course, everybody in the province getting the special diet has to reapply under the new program, so that in and of itself will reduce people's getting the money by massive numbers.
Mm-hmm. Especially because we're hearing all the time about doctor shortages, and so many people don't have family doctors, yet they have to get forms refilled out in order to access this benefit. And when are these changes going to be coming into effect?
Well, if you're on welfare and disability, you've already gotten a letter that sort of Rosalie described the changes that are happening. And they're beginning to send out the new forms that will take effect April 1st. We actually have a demonstration that marks that date. And then in July 31st, the changes will take effect fully. So we're expecting thousands and thousands of people will be cut off the special diet altogether, and many, many people will lose substantial amounts of income.
If you're on social assistance right now and getting the special diet, are there things that you would recommend to people who are facing their diets being reduced or potentially being cut off?
It's going to be in your best interest pretty much across the board to wait to hand in the form until early July if you think you will qualify at all. Because if you do qualify, you're likely to lose money. You can always take the form to your doctor and see if you think or if the doctor will sign for anything without actually getting it signed and handing it in. But you want to lose that money as possible.
Are you still there, Rachel?
Yep.
Okay, sorry, you're cutting in and out a little bit.
Oh, sorry about that.
And can you just tell us a bit about the resistance that is being planned around the special diet?
What we're saying is that, you know, they need to bring back the special diet, a proper program that addresses people's medical needs. But the fact is that we don't want to have a doctor prescribe us a special diet that will allow us to eat and to provide for our families, that they need to actually raise assistance rates across the board by 55%, which is what it would take to match the Harris cut over 16 years ago. So we have upcoming on the 19th of March at 2 p.m. at the Davenport Perth Community Center an assembly to talk about building a provincial movement to fight the changes and to fight for a raise to welfare and disability rates. And then on April 1st, we have a demonstration that'll be a first go at it in terms of these final changes, we'll be mobilizing people across the province.
Okay, and can you just maybe tell us, for folks who aren't on social assistance, why they should be concerned about the special diet and about low social assistance rates?
Well, I think that, if you know what it takes to live in Toronto, hopefully you want to support others who are struggling and really not able to live in this city or province on what people get, and that you could, join your friends and neighbors and your family in fighting for that right to an income that you can actually live on.
Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us, Rachel.
Thank you.
We're just going to go to a musical break right now before our next interview.
I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that is planted by the water side. Just like the tree that is planted by the water side. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved.
Those two songs were from Nahila. The first one was I Shall Not Be Moved, and the second was The Seventh Mystic. Next, we will be listening to a pre-recorded clip from John Clark about the Rob Ford action at City Hall that occurred on February 10th.
On February the 10th, we had our first major confrontation with the Ford administration, and a whole group of members of OCAP, No One Is Illegal, a series of community organizations, people joined us, and we went down to City Hall to confront the budget committee that was deliberating, the final meeting of their budget committee. They were deciding upon the first round of attacks that they're going to be making on people, the poor and working people throughout this city, and we went into the budget committee and shut down their proceedings and denounced them. There was some back and forth with some of the council members, most notably Doug Ford, who distinguished himself by telling somebody he presumed to be on social assistance to go and get a job. And after a period of time, the councillors left under security escort. There was a loud and angry demonstration. A couple of people were, in fact, arrested. And at the end of the thing, we left, and we recognise that the attack that took place, that's taking place in this budget, is targeting people who are affected by homelessness. It's removing shelter beds from the system. It's targeting refugees. It's beginning to cut TTC services. It's removing funding for legal support for tenants. It's quite a vicious initial attack. But this year, because they had capital expenditure money available to them, the cuts were somewhat blunted. What's clear is that Ford is planning very much worse, very much deeper cuts. He's talking now in terms of bringing in high-paid consultants to look at what can be cut. They're talking about privatizing garbage. They're talking about attacking TTC workers. They're talking about gutting public services, and they're talking about hammering the workers who deliver those services. And we went down there, we and the allies who were part of the contingent to City Hall went down there not just to make a statement to the Ford administration, but to say to trade unions, to say to communities under attack throughout this city that we have to build a common front to fight back and to resist what's happening. Ford represents the local component of an international agenda of austerity that is now playing itself out in the lives of working people viciously. Ford is a particularly enthusiastic and ugly representation of that agenda here locally, and we're going to have to mobilise if we don't want to see the face of this city changed in ways that are going to be devastating and drive us back in a whole series of really very, very terrible ways.
Those Oriental people work like dogs. They're slowly taking over. They're slowly taking over.
I support traditional marriage. I always have. I support traditional marriage. I always have.
This is a bylaw opening the door, a homeless shelter, in their ward. This is a bylaw opening the door. This is a bylaw, ding, 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 ding. What do we have, a public lynching? That's the black and white of the issue here. What do we have, a public lynching? Public lynching. Homeless lynching. Public lynching. Homeless lynching.
I can't support bike lanes. And what I compare bike lanes to is swimming with the sharks.
Swimming with the sharks.
Sooner or later, you're going to get bitten. And, you know, I feel my heart bleeds for them when I hear someone gets killed. But it's their own fault at the end of the day.
This is a political game.
I support traditional marriage.
This is a political game.
I support traditional marriage.
This is a political game. This is a political game.
Where I'm going to die.
The first song you heard was the Rob Ford song from Ben Bergen, a mayoral candidate. And the second song you heard was from Olenka and the Modern Lovers, Flash in the Pan. And here's AJ.
Okay, so up next we have an interview that Christian Schwartz recorded with Cynthia McKinney, a former U.S. Congresswoman and the first African-American woman in the House of Representatives in Georgia. In 2006, she introduced articles of impeachment against George Bush for the invasion of Iraq and for domestic spying. She soon after left the Democratic Party and in 2008 became the Green Party presidential nominee.
One of our most famous civil rights movement songs in the United States is by Gil Scott-Heron. He sings, "You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. Because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live. Hosni Mubarak is gone. Freedom-loving people all over the world are celebrating. We all watched on the floor, perched on the edges of our chairs. We were glued to our televisions. But just like Gil Scott-Heron says, the revolution was not on television. The revolution took place within the minds of individual citizens who suddenly awakened to their own strength by overcoming their fears. Fear permits you to bend your back. And as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stated so long ago, a man can only ride your back if it's bent. The people discovered themselves, and they overcame an oppressive state imposed on them by outsiders from the United States, the United Kingdom, Europe, and Israel, with Canada and Australia along for the ride. These countries rode the backs of the Egyptian people for as long as the Egyptian people allowed them to ride. And then the revolution within the minds of the people gave us and them something to celebrate. On February 11, 2011, the people of Egypt made history. They proved that with determination, unity, organization, and critical mass, the mightiest walls of oppression can come tumbling down. Ben Ali in Tunisia is gone. Crowds have amassed in Yemen, where President Saleh promised not to seek another term. Jordan, where King Abdullah replaced his prime minister. Algeria, where President Bouteflika said he would lift emergency powers, address unemployment, and allow democratic marches to take place. Apparently, 30,000 protesters showed up, and despite the pledge, approximately 1,000 were arrested, and others were beaten by Bouteflika's police. Protests are scheduled for Italy tomorrow. In Bahrain, a large march is planned for February 14th, the anniversary of the Bahraini Constitution. Pakistan is on the brink, with the foreign minister resigning and United States issuing a threat to sever relations if an American killer is not released after one of the embassy's hired guns killed three Pakistanis in cold blood, according to the Pakistani police. And a fourth Pakistani killed herself after her husband was killed by the American. Who'd have thought we would see this day? Once again, the world is rising up against oppression. I'm reminded of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s last speech before he was murdered, when he rejoiced to be living at the end of the 20th century, when men and women all over the planet were saying, "We want to be free." Well, this is a pretty nice time to be living in the 21st century when people are doing the same thing. However, I do want to take a moment to remember that we have been at this celebratory moment before, because while we rejoice at what is happening, we must not relent. The Western world shuddered when Patrice Lumumba was elected by the people of Congo, and so they killed him. And when it was time for Mobutu to go, they brought in Laurent Kabila, who proved to be too patriotic for them, and so he was killed too. The Congolese were clear that they not only had to get rid of Mobutu, but of Mobutuism. With the murder of Laurent Kabila, they have not been able to achieve their goal. Right now, the West is searching desperately for their next marionette to dangle in front of the people. I see them already rehearsing. The West's person will be an avatar of a freedom fighter, but will really be in place to serve the West and not the people. From Tunisia to the Republic of South Africa, we must beware the incomplete revolution where we see face change and not regime change.
That was Cynthia McKinney, former U.S. Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate. Among her many contributions to movements for peace and justice, she twice attempted to deliver humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. She was a guest speaker 2 weeks ago at an event organized by the Islamic Center of York Region, and we are playing that piece in honor of the end of African Liberation Month. And I want to thank everyone for listening to the show. We have a new format, which is once a month for 1 hour. Our next show is March 25th, and we will be playing the fourth Friday of every month. I want to let people know about a couple of upcoming events. Tomorrow, there will be a solidarity rally with the people of Libya at Dundas Square at noon. On March 7th to 11th is Israeli Apartheid Week. So for more information on that, there will be multiple events every single day throughout that week. Go to toronto.apartheidweek.org. And on March 19th, as Rachel already said, OCAP will be having a general assembly about the special diet and the Raise the Rates campaign at the Davenport Perth Neighborhood Center, 1900 Dundas Street West at 2 p.m. This has been Radio OCAP on CKLN 88.1 from the Ryerson University campus, and we'd like to thank Mark, our tech, and Sheetal, Susie, Kristen, and Steph for their support. And also just another reminder, for information about OCAP, visit ocap.ca or call 416-925-6939. And you can also go to the CKLN website and help save CKLN at ckln.fm. Coming up next is Vantana El Barrio with Susie Alvarez.